Thanks. That's My name's Joe, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I want to let you know I approve of this message. Just wanted to get that out there right quick. I wanted to thank everybody that had me and my wife down for the last few days. It's been very, very enjoyable. I had an opportunity to share my story here about 10 years ago in the springtime. And Will was here. I remember his face. It's amazing how you remember people like that. And in the last few years, I've had the opportunity to go back and revisit places that I was asked to speak 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 19 years ago. And I'm just overwhelmed because I don't know about anybody here if you've ever done anything like this, but for heaven's sakes, you're looking at a man that knows he really doesn't deserve to be here. And I don't say, well, I'm supposed to be here because I'm somebody and I'm a good speaker and that's why I'm here. I look out here and I go, oh my God, I just can't believe this is still going on after all these years. And I want to thank every one of you for being here for me and my wife and my family all these years. It's really meant a whole lot, because without you, I really wouldn't have a story to tell. There's something that's been bugging me, though. Sterling, it seems to me there's an overabundance of gentlemen in this town. There are gentlemen's clubs all over the place. Did you notice that? I kept looking all these. I thought, well, Sterling, there's a lot of Southern gentlemen down here. There's so many of them, they have clubs for them. And I was thinking about Chuck's talk. Maybe that's the problem with you living next to those whorehouses. You don't have any gentlemen's clubs up there. They ought to move that north, shouldn't they? That's what they should do. I don't know if any of you had ever seen that movie they had out about how AA got started. I think it was My Name is Bill W. or something like that. And I just love that story. And the part I love about it was when Bill went to see Bob. And Bob was telling his wife, Ann, I'll give this guy a few minutes. I've been prayed over, dunked, rejuvenated. I've just been in everything you can think of. I'm tired of people trying to help me. Been in the Oxford movement. I've just been in everything. I'll just give this guy a few minutes of my time and just tell him to move on. And Bill comes in, and he pretty much tells Bill the same thing. He says, I don't know what you can do to help me. I've been to everything you can think of. People prayed over me, and I've been to different churches. And Bill just kind of stopped you and said, oh, I'm not here to help you. I'm here to help myself. And it just totally disarmed Bob. Bob had never heard anything like that, because people had always tried to help Bob. Bill says, oh, no, I'm here to stay sober myself. I've been trying to tell my story for the last 6 months now. I haven't run across anybody that's been sober, but it's kept me sober. So I'm just going to share my story with you, because I've been a little afraid. I've been on a business deal that fell through, and I'm out of town. I'm alone, and I just needed somebody to tell my story to. And it just totally disarmed Bob, and he had him. He had him right here in the palm of his hand. And I'm here to share with you. I am not here to help you. I am not here to help anybody here. I am here to help ensure my sobriety, because I found early in my sobriety that by sharing my story, it helped me to stay sober another day. It's really that simple. There's no big magic thing about it. I'm really here to ensure my sobriety. And I found out I can have fun doing it. He calls it enthusiasm. I call it fun. Call it what you want. But I've been having a lot of fun since October 5th, 1978. And I never thought I'd ever be sober that long in my life. I just never did. I always thought sober was not drinking. That's how much I knew about sobriety. But I was not always sick. I was one of those kids that grew up out in the suburbs in Cincinnati. I didn't feel like a round peg in a square hole. I didn't come from a disadvantaged home. I was just your regular kid out there. There was nothing out of the ordinary about me or my life. Or, you know, you hear some really sad stories of people coming into AA, and you think, oh, my God, they didn't have a chance. Well, I had a good chance. We lived on a little dead-end street in a suburb of Cincinnati called North College Hill. They call them cul-de-sacs today. It's a dead-end street. That's where I grew up on. The street just stops, and we lived about four houses from the end. And it was a wonderful place to grow up in. My mother still lives there today. A little house, 825 square feet, two bedrooms. It was wonderful. People could sit in the street. They could play kick the can at 9, 10 o'clock at night. Everybody knew everybody. If there was a strange car that come down the street, they knew. They didn't belong there. They knew that. It was and nothing was out of the ordinary. There wasn't this strain on everybody. It was just a regular old childhood's all it was. I had some strange relatives. My grandpa, my mother's father, he was a drunk. And he used to like to come down the dead end street with his buddy in the yellow cab. And he'd be drunk too. And they'd pull up in the driveway, and my dad look out in the driveway, and Grandpa would get out of the yellow cab and open the trunk, and they'd be drunk and walking around with a possum on a leash. And my dad's going, "Oh, Jesus, Jubal, get your father out there. He's drunk walking a possum on a leash. What would the neighbors think?" And my brother and I, we're 6 and 9. We're going, "Isn't that cool? Look at that." You know, we saw, that's entertainment. Who else's grandpa do you know walks a possum around on a leash? My grandpa does. That's cool, you know. But it was an embarrassment to my mother because that was her father. And it was an embarrassment to my father because it looked bad on the family. You know what I mean? But we didn't really think much about that. And then we used to go visit my mother's mother. She lived in the state mental institution. A lot of people go to places like Myrtle Beach in the summer. We'd go to places like Building A and Cell Block 6 to visit relatives. But we'd all get in the car and go visit Grandma. Grandma lived in the state mental institution. She lived there for 40 years of her life. She went in when she was 24. She died when she was 64 of ovarian cancer. And she was in there because of alcoholism. And we never knew that till after she died. And we all got sober and we go, "Oh, my God, she was there from alcoholism." But we would go out and we'd get in the aunts and uncles and cousins. We'd get in the car and we'd go visit relatives at the state nut house. You know, other people going on picnics. We're going to the commissary at Longview State Hospital. And they'd bring Grandma in. They had her on some good stuff. She'd be rocking back and forth and spitting and babbling and all that. And my mother and her two sisters, my aunts, would get her there and they'd say, "Oh, she said she want coffee." I said, "How'd you get out of coffee? How'd you know that? I can't understand what she's saying." You know what I mean? But we didn't think anything about it. I mean, even as a kid, I had some kind of compassion for people who had problems. I just thought, wow, what a way to live. That's terrible. That's terrible. And I wasn't ashamed of Grandma being in the hospital. You know, that's just what happens to people. You know what I mean? And I thought everybody had somebody crazy in their family. You know? And I was right. When I got to AA, we did have somebody crazy. It's us. But I never looked at it like, "Oh, don't tell nobody my grandma's in the state nut house." I didn't think anything of it, really. And so we had a pretty normal childhood growing up. And you know what? As a young boy, I had a positive, can-do kind of attitude. It was the way God made me. I was just the way I was. You know what I mean? I don't think I felt any different in my adolescent years than anybody else should feel. You're supposed to feel bizarre in your adolescent years. Your hormones are going wacko, and you're trying to find out who you are and how to get along socially with people and all that. And, you know, people come to AA and go, "Oh, that's why I'm that way." No, everybody felt that way. You know, we were lucky. Alcohol helped us bypass adolescence. We didn't have to feel rejection or any of that stuff. But before I got into adolescence, I was a positive young kid. I didn't feel disadvantaged or anything like that. And I remember as a young boy, I watched Walter Cronkite on Sunday night. I think it was the 21st century, and this guy had built an incubator to make hatch chickens. And I was about 9 or 10 years old. I thought, "Wow, I'm going to do that. I am going to do that." And I remember going to school as a kid going, "I'm going to build an incubator to hatch chickens." They go, "You can't do that." And I remember as a young kid at 10 years old, I thought, "Don't need you. Got to find out somebody to show me how to make this incubator." Telling me I couldn't do it didn't stop me because I had already made my mind up. I was going to do that. I was going to find out how to do that. And, you know, within a month or two, I had found out how to do that. I had found the people to help me, had a little formica incubator with a rheostat on the back and tile on the inside with little duck decals. And 21 days later, I had chickens running all over my mother's living room. You know what I mean? That's the kind of guy I was. I didn't feel disadvantaged or goofy or anything like that. I didn't start feeling weird till the Beatles came out. And you see his hair. You know what I mean? Everybody had long, straight hair. I did feel kind of weird about that. And Jimi Hendrix came along. I felt all right. You know what I mean? Just, go ahead, Jimmy. But, the thing was, I guess what I'm trying to say is I was a positive young kid. I really was. And my mother's drinking started to pick up. And back then in the 60s, they gave speed to women for everything, from toxemia to losing weight. They gave her black mollies, black and white mollies, dexedrine, all that. And my mother's drinking's picking up. She'd drink quarts of beer. And my mother's about 5'2", and she had gained a lot of weight. She was about 190 pounds, and she wore one of these smocks, looked like a small circus tent. And she'd walk around like this, and she'd be half drunk and just blinking like this all the time on that speed. And I didn't really think nothing of it. I think, well, that's just Mom, you know. And but I thought, she does act like her mother in the state mental institution. There's something wrong there. And when I was about, oh, my goodness, when I was about 12 years old, my brother was 9, my dad's a drunk. He came home one day, and he got me and my brother out in the backyard. He says, come here, I want to tell you boys something. And we said, what, Dad? He said, if it wasn't for your mother, I'd be long gone. Your mother's crazy. Now, when you're that age, Dad's God. He doesn't lie. And I didn't know till I got to A, he got the spotlight off of him and his drinking, put it all on Mom. You know what I mean? And we went, yeah, she does act like Grandma in the nut house. She is crazy. And but around this time, you know, that was the 60s. And I want to say this. I just love the 60s. The 60s were a wonderful time to grow up in. There was something going on every day. Every night, Walter Cronkite would bring in the Vietnam War, night after night after night. Body bags, helicopters, riots on college campus against the Vietnam War. You know what I mean? You did the Democratic National Convention, they beat the hell out of us. You remember that? They beat them people to death. You know, they went to the moon in the 60s. Wow. That was awesome. The president got shot. His brother got shot. Martin Luther King got shot. It was something going on all. I get chills thinking about it. It's just an amazing. I mean, I come home as a kid going, my God, well, I wonder what's going to happen today. It was just, it was a turbulent time to grow up in, but it was an exciting time to grow up in. And I was just your regular run-of-the-mill kid in seventh grade. It's 1967, and a guy across the street, he just got his driver's license. Said, hey, this girl over at the high school wants to know if you want to go to a party. Wow. I said, well, how old is she? She said, well, she's a senior. Whoa. You remember when you were 13 and people were 18, they had beards and stuff, and they were all grown up? It's like, wow. You know, I mean, when you're 13 and they're 18, that's called opportunity. Do you remember that? And I thought, well, yeah, I'll go. And I went to this party, not looking to fit in. It was an innocent thing. Totally, totally innocent. I wasn't trying to fit in. I wasn't trying to be. It was just, you want to go? Yeah. And I get over there, and they're playing all this wild rock and roll. Now, it's 1967, Sterling. I didn't know I was coming today, so just relax. I went in there, and they're smoking all this weird stuff. It looks like American flags, and they were yellow and pink and white and all that. I thought, what are they doing? I'm 13 years old. And all of a sudden it hit me. I went, oh, I know what that is. Here, sit down, kid. And they got me smoking this stuff. They got me smoking. And believe me, I'm not here to try to upset the apple cart in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 13 years old. I wasn't going, this will piss them off in AA in the next century. I didn't know I was coming. I had no idea I was coming to AA. It's just my story. And there's a point to me telling this. I had smoked that stuff, and all of a sudden I looked around. I went, oh, my God. I mean, this will date me. Everything was in Technicolor. It was all, the volume was on volume 10. I thought, wow, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. But here's the thing I noticed immediately. My tongue was stuck to the roof of my mouth. And they're all laughing. These seniors and juniors in high school, they're laughing, going, look at that, the kid's got cotton mouth. I said, you have anything to drink? And they took me into the kitchen. And these people obviously had been doing this stuff for a while. And they were as goofy as I was. And they're laughing. They're laughing. I thought, what are they laughing at? They were so goofy and stoned, they were laughing about somebody dropped a can opener on the floor. They were laughing so hard they were crying. Like it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen in their life. And I'm going, I need something to drink, my mouth. And they go, here, kid. What's this? Valley High wine. Did you hear that? Just went over the whole crowd. I go, whoa. Yeah. Yeah, I get warm thinking about it. And I cracked the top on that wine, and I start drinking, and these people, they're still laughing about the can opener on the floor, and I'm drinking this wine. I'm drinking on it was like fruit punch. It was like high C. or Tahitian treat. It was good. I couldn't stop. Before you know it, the bottle's empty. And they all look around and go, "You're supposed to pass that." I'm 13 years old. I go, "Nobody told me." And you know what? For years, I thought I drank that whole bottle of Bally High because that marijuana made me thirsty. It wasn't until I come to AA I found out about the physical allergy that once I start, I'm not going to stop. You know what I mean? But I didn't know that. You know what I mean? So I didn't immediately become obsessed. But one thing I did remember, I remember this warm feeling coming all over me from that Bally High wine. And I might not have been 18, but I felt 18, and I felt like one of them. It was a psychological moment in my life where I felt like I had arrived, and I wasn't even looking for a place to show up. I just felt I had arrived. You know what I mean? This feeling of a deserved accomplishment that you didn't do anything for. It was wonderful. And the thing I remember is, "You come back, kid. You're a lot of fun." You know what I mean? I was like their pet monkey. I was entertainment for them. Is what it was. But in my mind, they want me back. Wow. But they said, "You keep your mouth shut, kid. We'd go to jail a long time for that." You know what I mean? And then as I got older, I was about 14 years old, and this guy just got out of the penitentiary. I went to another drinking party. I was invited, and before you know it, this guy, I said, "What are all these people doing here? They look goofy." He said, "They're all doing this LSD stuff." I said, "Well, what is that?" He said, "Well, it makes you see stuff that's not there." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, it's called a hallucination." He said, "Remember, if you do it, what you see, it really ain't there. And you got to remember, you're the only one seeing what you're seeing. Everybody else is seeing something else. And if you don't like it, don't worry about it. It'll wear off in about 12 hours. Let me try that." Let me try that. Now, I wasn't going, "This will upset him in AA in 2004. I was an innocent kid in the 60s. I tried all this stuff, and I did it hundreds of times. And I tried everything. I tried, you name it, I tried it. I got into a thing doing speed, and I thought, well, you know, I had all these bruises from drinking this whiskey the other night. I can't remember how I got the bruises. I'm going to start doing this speed so I can be aware of what I'm doing." And I stayed up for 3 days thinking I was in control. And I found out when you can't sleep and you can't eat and you can't pee, you're not in control. And I'd be going, "Do you have anything to drink so I can relax? I'm really tired of being awake. You know, how about some Southern Comfort? You know, woo." And looking back on it now, alcohol was my solution for everything. Even being up for 3 days, dry mouth. You know, I wasn't going for cases of Diet Coke. I was going for alcohol. Alcohol was doing something for me. And as time went by, I started drinking Strawberry Hill and Boone's Farm apple wine and all the stuff that people were drinking then. And what I didn't know was, is the drinking was picking up more and more over here. That's what was happening the whole time. Regardless of me dilly-dallying and all this other stuff, the alcohol was picking up. I am an alcoholic. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And I got to be about 16 years old, and my life started spinning out of control, and I started to become prey to my own emotions. I couldn't think straight. I was making decisions based on what booze was making for me. You know, I'd stop making the decisions. Alcohol started making them for me, and I would get in arguments with my mother and end up hitchhiking to Florida with 9 cents in my pocket in February with no coat because I was having a bad day. Just why? I wouldn't even think about it. It made sense to me at the time. It just made sense. I remember I was living in a trailer park at 16 years old, North Miami Beach, working in a Chinese restaurant. Had hair out to here. One of them big afros. You know, you turn your head and hair catch up to it. Big one. And I'm a busboy in a Chinese restaurant. I'm the only guy in there not Chinese. Big hair like that going, "Egg roll." Them Chinese people were laughing. They go, "Crazy white boy," they're just laughing, you know. And I'm sure they had a good time with me. I really did. But I had to pay the rent. You know, I lived in this trailer and all that. And I was 16 years old. I got homesick. It was 1971. I was just a young kid, you know. My father had stopped coming home, so that kind of took all the restrictions off of any kind of discipline or law in the house. So I just went wacko. And I got into a habit of leaving home when things didn't go my way. That's really what it boiled down to. And one time I had left home in 1972, I had hair out to here. The guy with me had hair down to his rear end, and we got thrown in jail in Cordele, Georgia for hitchhiking. Now, if you're not from Cordele, they don't like you. It don't matter what color you are, they do not like you at all. And the guy that pulled me and this fellow over that were hitchhiking, he had mirror glasses on. Remember the old Dodge commercial, what you got under the hood, boy? He had that big mirror glasses, big stomach out to here, and I could see my reflection in his sunglasses when he walked up to me. My hair's out to here. I go, this is not going to be good. And he gave me the once over. He looked me up and looked me down. He said, you white or black, boy? And I didn't know your rectum could tighten up that fast. Man, it just scared me to death. You ever get real scared and tighten up like that? And here's what really bothered me. I just seen that movie Deliverance. You remember that movie? I could hear that banjo going, oh, my God. And there was a guy with him. He had a real tall, skinny Barney Fife kind of guy with him. He kind of bouncing like Barney. I remember it bouncing like Barney. He said, we tie these boys up, throw them in a swamp. Nobody know a thing about it. They were having a real good time with us. You know, and I thought of that movie Deliverance again where the guy said, squeal like a pig. Oh, my God, you know. And the whole point of this story is I couldn't explain to you how I got in this predicament. How did I end up here of all places? This is a bad dream. I'd go down to Florida, I'd work for a while and come back, and before you know it, I started breaking the law, and I was looking at either going to the penitentiary or going into the military. And at that time, you could go into the military to get out of going to jail for a long time. And I went into the military. I finished the 10th grade of high school. I dropped out my junior year, and I went into the Navy. And I'm going to start over. All drunks start over. It doesn't matter what your age is. You could be 65. You can be 15. We're all going to start over. Because I thought I was making bad choices in my life. I didn't know anything about the obsession. You know, a lot of people call alcoholism addiction. Very little to do with addiction. I had an obsession. An obsession is an idea that crowds out all other ideas. That once I have it on my mind, I'm not going to do anything else. Oh, I could want to do something else, but I'm not going to. You know what I mean? I'm going to show up for work today. Before you know it, the obsession wins out. I don't show up to work. You know what? I'm going to start over. I'm going to get a new career. No, I'm going to do what the obsession tells me to do. Alcohol put me in the Navy. Alcohol got me out of the Navy. I was in there a year and a half. They threw me in the bottom of a ship in a boiler room. I'm 17 years old. I'm going, this is not a good thing down the bottom of this ship. And it wasn't until I got out in the middle of the ocean that I found out that I had to have a drink. And that's a bad place to find out you need a drink in the middle of the ocean. You don't have anything to drink. Now, I know that's what it was. I know that's what it was back then right now. I didn't know it then. All I knew was that it's hot. People are screaming at me. And I've got to work all these hours. And the ship won't stop rolling. Jeez, I made a bad decision. If I'd have just got a job in one of those air-conditioned offices, a yeoman, maybe I'd make a career out of it. But this boiler room, it's like jet engines screaming, and it's 120 degrees, and God, you know what I mean? That was the obsession to drink, and I didn't know that back then. I know that now. And I told these guys that were like 25 years old, I'm getting out of the Navy. You can't get out of the Navy, kid. You signed up for 4 years. You know, you don't tell an alcoholic you can't. And what they did is they gave me a little incentive to get out. And I went through the Bupers manual, the United States Navy, and I found discharges. I looked in the back, drug addict? No, you get out one of those, you can never get a job. Alcoholic? No, my mother's nuts. She's one of them. I'm not one of them. Bilateral pes planus, flat feet. Oh, I can do that. What do I need to do here? And I just started following the directions. I just followed the requirements. I'm a can-do kind of guy. Remember, I can if I want to do it, you're not going to stop me. And I got out of the Navy on flat feet. Year and a half, I was out. Now, I didn't know why I'd gotten out on flat feet. I didn't know that the obsession said, got to leave the Navy. You can't drink like I want you to drink out here in the ocean. You've got to get back to land. And I went back home to help my mother, and I got a good job, and I learned the job. I was working at a mill, making mills off of mills, a big machine shop called Cincinnati Millicron, and all of a sudden, I started to drink one day, and I did not show up to work for 2 weeks. I could not stop. I'm 19, 20 years old, and the boss calls up my mother's house where I was living. He says, do you work here anymore? I says, no, as a matter of fact, I've made a career change. I'm going to truck driving school. I'll be in to get my check. That just came right out of my mouth. I wasn't going to truck driving school. Well, what are you going to do? Tell them, I'm drinking and I can't stop. I don't know when I'll be in. You know, you don't know that. And you can't tell them that because they'll think you're crazy. They'll think you're nuts. Like Grandma out in Longview. I watched what they did to people in that mental institution. I'm not going out there. Never let them know you have anything wrong with you. They might put you out there where Grandma is. You know, an alcoholic like me has to have a fast answer of why they do what they do. Because they really don't know that it's the obsession calling the shots. They really don't know why they do what they do. I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing. I mean, I always tell this story. I remember I passed out with my pants down around my ankles at a party one night. And I woke up the next day, and this girl says, how come your pants were down around your ankles last night? I didn't even think about it. It just came right out. I said, because I was hot. What really bothered me was that my pants were no longer down around my ankles. I thought, I wonder who pulled them up. But you can't let anybody know. You don't know why your own pants were down around your ankles. So you have to be real, real quick. Because if you don't, they'll think you're nuts. And I had become a violent drunk. And I was always a good time Charlie, but I started to become violent. And I was coming home at 3 or 4 in the morning. And I was feeling sorry for myself. I was watching other people my age getting married and getting jobs and homes and cars and families. And here I am just coming home drunk in my mother's house at 3:45 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning. Now, my mother had joined Alcoholics Anonymous when I was in the Navy in 1971. She's been sober, remember, since 71. And we just all thought she was crazy. Because Dad said she was crazy, and Dad don't lie. So we just didn't think, oh, she's not an alcoholic. She might be a little goofy, but I don't pay too much attention to Mom. She's not right. And but she was going to AA, and I'm coming home drunk. Me and my brother are coming home drunk at 3:30 in the morning. And my mother's standing there in the kitchen, and I'm cussing my mother out at 3:30 in the morning, calling her all kind of names. I was never taught to call any woman in my life, let alone my mother. And if you're an alcoholic, you know exactly what I called her. I'm watching the tears stream down my mother's cheeks, and I'm saying, you're crazy. Mom, you're crazy. You say I have a drinking problem. Just because you go to AA, you think everybody that drinks has a drinking problem. Those people have brainwashed you. Get out of my face. And I mean, it wasn't that nice. You know, I would come home and I'd put my fist through walls and tear doors off the hinges and throw lamps and fans that were plugged in and on. Just boom and fits of rage. And I would punch a door and bust it right through the frame of the opposite direction that it's supposed to open. And wonder why my mom had looked at me with these eyes of terror. You know what I mean? And even when I was drunk cussing my mother out like that, I would think, why are you talking to your own mother like that? What the heck is wrong with you, Joe? But I couldn't let anybody know that there was something wrong with me because I'd be out there at the state mental institution like Grandma. I'm not going out there. And finally, she got to the point where she was tired of me and my brother coming home drunk all the time on whiskey at 3 or 4 in the morning drinking Jack Daniels and just flopping out. And she said, you and your brother are going to have to get out. I said, well, can you give us about a week? She said, no, tomorrow. Tomorrow. So I put all my belongings in three green hefty trash can liners. I had colors, black and whites, and miscellaneous. That's how I packed. And I put them in the back of a 71 Chevy pickup truck. It was yellow. And I went down to No Hope, Kentucky on 15th and Scott over the Ohio River as Skid Row. And I had the sleeping room down there. It was your typical Skid Row sleeping room for people like me. I had a bare mattress on the floor for a bed and a cardboard box turned upside down for an end table. I had plastic curtains with grease on the blinds. I had a four-pane window that was broken out, and the breeze would tatter that plastic curtain. My light hung from a wire on the ceiling, and I had a sink in my room. And all 10 guys, I'm the only guy under 65 in the building. We all share the same bathtub and the same toilet upstairs on the second floor. But alcohol's still working for me, man. Alcohol's still working for me. I come in here at 3:40 in the morning, I'd hit that light, man. Them roaches would scatter all over the place. Roaches do not like a light. I don't know what that is. But that didn't bother me because everything was going okay. I didn't have to hear my mother complain about my drinking. So I'd slam the door shut. I'd be wiped out. I'd be laying down there on that bare mattress. And if you live in an atmosphere like that long enough, sooner or later, You're laying there like that, and you wake up, something's going like this right in your eye like that, and you go, it's a roach, and you're going, my God, boom, everybody's got to have a place to live. You know, alcohol's still working for me. Or I'd look at the mattress, and I'd go, what is going on? Alcohol'd say, hey, relax. We'll get you box spring sheets, pillows. We'll get you up off the floor, but right now you just hang in there. And I'd say, well, all right. Let's go right on back out again. Or I'd look over at my end table, my cardboard box. I go, what are you doing? I'd put my room, my change on there, my key and my 6 cents. And I'd look over and I go, a box? The alcohol would say, hey, relax. We'll get you real wood one day. You just hang in there, man. And I'd say, well, all right. I just go right on back out. And by this time in my life, all those drugs that I was talking about earlier, I had stopped doing. I can't tell you when I stopped. As much as I did that stuff, I can't tell you when I stopped. I'm drinking alcohol around the clock. I don't even know when that stopped. For some reason, it could stop, but the alcohol couldn't. And it was January the 18th, 1977, the following year, and it got down to 25 below that night, and the wind chill factor was 70 below. It was one of the coldest days on record in Cincinnati. And I had been out of work for a while. I couldn't work anymore, and I hitchhiked back over the river into Ohio and went back up to the community where I'd grown up as a kid to hustle drinks. Now, I didn't know that's what I was doing, but I know that's what I was doing now. Yeah, and it's easy to hustle drinks. Hey, Chuck, I haven't seen you in a while. Let me buy you a drink. Yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't you buy me a drink? And that's how I would hustle drinks like that. But I was one of those crazy people that once I started to drink, I didn't know how I was going to act. And the door closed at 2:30 in the morning. I have no hat on, no gloves. I have an old Navy pea coat on with bib overalls, socks, and shoes. People said, don't put him in your car. Don't put him in your car. Last night I drove him in my car. We're going down the street, and he grabbed the steering wheel and started laughing at me. Going all over. Yeah, don't put him in your car. So people would leave. They didn't want me in their car. And I'm walking. I walked about a mile and a half, and somebody had pity on me and picked me up and took me downtown to the Dixie Terminal building. And I looked up at the clock. It was around 4 in the morning. And I'm walking over the Ohio River, over the bridge, over the river. So cold. And I'm in the middle of that bridge that night. You know, I'm out there and it's howling. Wind chill 70 below, no hat, no gloves, just the pea coat on, socks and shoes. And if you just stopped me in the middle of that bridge that night and said, hey, Joe, you think you have a problem with your drinking? I'd say, well, hell no. I don't have a problem with my drinking. I've got 30 cents, but the buses aren't running. I have a transportation problem. I drink fine. You know, but while you're out here and I'm out here, let me tell you what my problem is. It's that mother that kicked me out, that one that joined AA. She's bizarre. That's really my problem. And you know, if my mother wouldn't have joined AA and got sober, my parents would still be married today and I'd be a college graduate. That's exactly what my problem is. My problem is the Navy. If I'd have got a better job, I wouldn't have been down that boiler room. If I got one of those nice air-conditioned jobs like a radar man, I'd have been a 30-year man. That's why I'm here. I can tell you why. It's because I have a GED. I don't have any education. That's my problem. It's the girlfriend that dumped me. It's the car that gets frozen to the curb and towed away. But it's surely not alcohol. Alcohol is the thing that let me dance at the high school dance. It's the thing that let me ask the girls and say, would you like to dance? Man, I wasn't because I was immature and sober I couldn't do it. I was afraid. You know, when I drank, hell, I said, hey, Chuck, you want to dance? You know, I'd ask the guys to dance. I didn't care anymore. So anything that makes you feel that good surely can't be the problem. And I walked away. And it was springtime, 1977. I'm 22 years old. I can't work anymore. I got the truck back somehow. And I had a spiritual awakening that introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to take you through that. But you'll never guess who I called. My mother. Of all people. I was going to burn her house down. I thought, I can't live here. You're not either. I'll burn you out. I mean, that's how I felt when she kicked me out, because I thought she's crazy. And I called my mother at the AA clubhouse. My mother was working. They paid people minimum wage to serve coffee there. It was kind of like a little job. And I called my mother. I said, Mom, this is Joe. She says, what do you want? Because, see, she had a restraining order on me and my brother. We weren't allowed within 100 feet of the house, or we were going to jail. My own mother was afraid of her own children. It was kind of sad. I said, how do you stay sober? And I heard her crying on the other end of the phone. Oh, my God, he's one of us.
Mom, can I, let me run this by you one more time. I'm out here on the street, and how do you stay sober? And she put me on the phone with a guy and said, hey, you think you have a problem with your drinking? I said, well, I don't know. I might. All I know is I don't feel like I have to drink anymore. He said, come on down to the meeting tonight. I go, I said, look, I feel like I've been on a merry-go-round going 90 miles an hour for the last 10 years, and it just stopped. I'm going to go back to the community bathtub on the second floor. I'm going to get cleaned up, and I'm going to go to bed, and I'll be down the next day. So on April the 10th, 1977, I'm 22 years old, and I go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hair out to here. Bib overalls on with nothing underneath. No shirt, no underwear, no socks. I'm glad it was the 70s. You can't get in most places like that today. And I walked in, and I knew when I walked in there, I knew somebody was going to say, why don't you get a haircut? Man, you have got that Charlie Manson look going. You look bad. You look real bad. Why don't you take a bath, man? That last one's null and void. You stink. You stink. Why don't you get a job? Why don't you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and go to work? And where in the hell is your underwear? Well, you know, I mean, I knew they were going to say that to me because that's what I said to myself every morning in that sleeping room down on Skid Row and looking into that mirror over that sink. When are you going to get a haircut? When are you going to get a job? Where is your underwear? Why, my goodness, what's wrong with you? But what I got was a guy that walked up to me that was old enough to be my father. He was 55 years old. Man, he was old. I'm 49. That's rather mild now. But at that age, you know, at 22, 30's over the hill. He was 55. He said, hey, it's really good to see you. Why don't you come on over here and have a cup of coffee with us? What's your name? And I thought, well, this guy, he's just trying to be nice to me because he knows my mother. I was sober 5 years before I found out on that day he didn't know who my mother was. He says, we don't know if you're an alcoholic like we are, but if you are, you're in the grips of a progressive, fatal, and incurable illness. Never gets any better without spiritual relief. And then this other woman over here, boy, she was old. She was 40. She was a housewife. And she said, if you want to find a way up and out of your problems, Joe, we'll share with you how we did it. It caught me. Share with you how we did it. Not, shut up, sit down, we'll tell you what to do. I think there's a big difference between laying the spiritual kit of tools at our feet for our inspection versus rubbing our nose in it like a dog that had an accident on the carpet. These are the spiritual tools, and you will do that. It's like, oh, what, man, what's wrong? And you don't give instruction to people with no underwear and no shirt on too early. I know that. And I heard a guy tell his story like I'm telling tonight, and he just got a sponsor. He was bragging about it. I got a sponsor. You really need to get a sponsor. You need to get a sponsor. And I looked around, and all these people were old enough to be my parents and grandparents. And I started making decisions that were wrong that helped save my life. I looked at them, and I thought, well, they're all old. They must all be sober. That was the first lie. Most of them were not sober. And the second lie that I believed was, since they're all old and they're all sober, they must all have one of these sponsors. I don't want to be the only guy walking out of here without one, whatever the hell they are. I want one. Oh, you know, you're neurotic. You know, you at least want to feel like you belong, even though you don't understand. So after the meeting, I turned to the guy next to me. I said, would you be my sponsor? And he says, yeah. And he's been my sponsor ever since. And I hear people say, I go to the discussion meetings, and this topic is how to pick a sponsor. And it'll get to me. I go, well, just ask somebody. Don't make a big deal out of it. And they'll look at it. Well, he's cocky, isn't he? I go, hey, it's just what I did. And he sat there and he explained to me what he did to stay sober. He gave me no direction. Some people thrive on direction and instruction, and that's fine. But this is my story, and this is what happened to me. He said, Joe, I have a home group I go to on every Wednesday. He said, I talk to my sponsor on a regular basis. I go down to the jail once a week. I go to an institution meeting. He says, I have read this book, and I have taken the steps. He says, you might want to try this. And he gave me this book. Now, I have no underwear, no socks, and no shirt. This guy's giving me a book. I don't even know what A is, let alone a sponsor is. It's my first meeting. He hands me a book, and I'm paging through it thinking, there's not one damn picture in this book. Did you see that? That's the only thing going through my mind. You know, and you would think they would have a before and after picture or something like Bill Wilson passed out in the bathtub. You know, like, here's Bill drunk, here's Bill sober. Look at that. I'm going to have to get... Was nothing in there. Nothing in there. And you know, it just... And this guy that was telling me what he did to stay sober seemed a little bit too happy about not drinking. I mean, it was almost like he was Disneyland happy. You know, you know how when you're new, everything's exaggerated. Hey, we're going out for coffee after the meeting. Yo-hoo. It's like, wow, you can't be that happy about coffee, man. My goodness, it's terrible. And of course, that isn't the way he laughed, but that's the way I heard it. And I want to let you know, I came to meetings for 89 days, and I went back to drinking again. I got the 89 days, and I went to my sponsor. I said, look, I might have had a problem with alcohol, but I don't think I've had a problem with that marijuana stuff. And he said, well, you know, if you haven't had a problem with it, I suggest you smoke it. I thought, out of everybody in the room, I had picked the best sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous right here. And he knew that if I was going to stay sober, I had to be here for Joe, and not because he said, don't you do that. And I went back to drinking Little King Ale. You know, when your higher power's in a bag, it runs out real quick. And I went right on back to drinking like I'd never missed a beat. And there was no smoking pot. That was just an excuse. You know what I mean? Every day after that, it was drinking around the clock. I'd come back to AA, stayed sober 4 months the next time, went to a meeting every day for 4 months, got drunk. Stayed sober 5 months the next time. Went to a meeting every day for 5 months. The last month, I chaired the meeting for 4 Mondays in a row. And I walked out of the meeting that I was chaired after 5 months of meetings, and I'm walking down the street, and my mind says, you know, a bottle of MD 2020 would be really good right now. And I, did you hear that? And my mind says, you're a big boy. Why don't you go get it? And I thought, well, yeah, I think I'll do that. And I went and I got that bottle of NB 2020, and I started drinking, and I come to find a loneliness and a desperation and a demoralization that I never knew existed. You know, we talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. What kind of demoralization? Pitiful and incomprehensible. We kind of gloss over that like, yeah. Go what? Read the next sentence. No. Let's talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's why I'm here. I don't ever want to go back to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Demoralized, where I'm living against everything I was ever taught to be right from wrong. That I'm not living up to any human standard. I'm reacting like an animal. I'm hating the world, and I'm hating myself, thinking I've made a bunch of wrong moves, and I'm a bad person. And it's all because of this obsession I don't even know I have. I don't know anything about the obsession. The obsession has convinced me I'm a bad person. The obsession has convinced me I'm a thief. The obsession has convinced me I'm a bad son. I'm a failure at the Navy. I'm a quitter. I'm a nobody. I'm never going to amount to nothing. And even AA doesn't work for people like me. I've been to AA 20, 30 times. It doesn't matter if you're nice to me. I'm leaving. Sooner or later, I leave. It's a bad feeling to sit in AA knowing you're going to drink after the meeting. What a hell of a feeling. That's a terrible feeling. And I left and I went through a hospital for alcoholism. And I came back on October 5th, 1978, which is my sobriety date. I was 23 years old, but I didn't know that was my sobriety date. All I knew was there was an eating meeting and I was going to get some food and act like a good AA member and get the hell out of there. These people are nice, but they're just a little too wacky for me. And I don't remember what was said at the meeting that night, but I remember what was said in my sponsor's car after the meeting. I'm sitting in my sponsor's car, and I'm shaking. I smell bad. I look bad. That's the hair out the ear, no underwear, no shirt, no job, no money. And I'm shaking like this. I'm smoking a cigarette, and I'm shaking like that. And my sponsor says, I want to thank you, Joe. You helped save my life. I said, oh, Christ. I got to listen to this stuff. Jesus. I said, oh, really, Mike? How's that? He said, yeah. He said, my mom died of leukemia this year. And he says, I made a deal with God. You saved my mother. I'll stay sober. She dies. I'm out of here. And I watched her shrivel up and die from the chemotherapy and the cancer. And every time I was ready to go back to drinking, you drank. And I saw what it was doing to you in your life. And I just figured, I don't need that right now in my life. Thanks. You really teach me a lot. You know what I thought in my mind? This guy's using me. He is hustling me. This guy's thanking me for saving his life. I'm thinking, he's using me. And I walked away from that car that night thinking, you think you're so smart. I'm going to do everything that dumb book says to do. Doesn't mean anything. I'm going to smoke the same cigarette you smoke. Tell the same stupid jokes you tell night after night. Eat the same food you eat. I'll show you it don't work. And I've been sober ever since then, October 5th, 1978. But I want to share something with you. You know, on my 23rd birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, for some reason, this came back to me. And you would think something like this wouldn't take so long to come back. But it just came real clear to me, and I remember like it was yesterday, about my 23rd birthday in AA. I remember I was sober 10 days. And I'm sitting in my sponsor's car. My sponsor, you know, saw me go in and out of AA, and he said, "Look, I'm not a taxi service. You get to the meeting, I'll ride you home. You want it, you come get it. You went to get the booze, come on and get the sobriety. We'll make sure you get home." And I'd hitchhike or take the bus or whatever I was going to do. And I'm sitting in his car after the meeting. He was going to ride me home. He was cool. He was just too cool. He was about 9 months older than me. He was about 24 years old. Got sober when he was 20. Got a 1972 orange Nova with mag wheels. He had that polyester suits and stuff. Had that disco thing looking, you know what I mean? He was cool. He was just something. And he sits there and he puts his key in the ignition. And before he turns it, he looks at me and he goes, "I need to tell you something as your sponsor." I said, "What?" He said, "I need to tell you that if you make staying sober and being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous the most important thing in your life, you will never have to worry about money. You will never have to worry about a job. You will never have to worry about relationships. All these things will be taken care of for you, I promise you." And for about 10 seconds, I looked at him and I thought, he's telling me the truth. Just as clear as could be. And a few seconds after that, it was, "Come on, man, let's get the hell out of here. I got laundry to do. Come on, let's go. It's getting late." You know, but it was a fleeting thing. But I was like, it was schizophrenic. On one point, I'm going, "I'll show you. I'll show you this stuff doesn't work." And on the other hand, it was, "You promised. You promised me that if I did this stuff would work." I was sober about 30 days and I was ready to run again. And that's a terrible feeling. I knew what that was. It was the obsession. I said, "Mike, what did you do when you got like this?" He said, "You've been reading that book?" I said, "Yeah, but it doesn't make much sense to me, though." He said, "Have you read about doing that inventory?" I said, "Yeah." He says, I wrote that inventory when I got like that." I said, "Well, how do you do that?" He said, "Just resentment, fear, and sex. Things that make you mad, put it down. People, places, and things, put it down. Things you're afraid of, write that stuff down. And fear, sex, you know what it is. The things you were never going to tell anybody about your sex life, you write that down." Oh, wow, I don't know about that. You know what I mean? But I thought, well, if you really need me to stay sober, like you say you do, I'll watch this. I'll tell him the truth. This will really blow his mind. He's probably never heard anything like this. And I started writing it down, you know, and I thought to myself, I thought I'd never tell anybody about the buffalo from Billings, Montana. Whoa, you know what I mean? Yeah, you know, and I read this stuff to him, and he finally got to the point about the sex. He said, "Well, you know, I read him about the buffalo." And he said, "Well, where were you at fault?" And I said, well, I lied to the buffalo. He said, "Well, what was the lie?" I said, "I love you." Funny now, man. Wasn't funny then. But you know what? Everybody's got a buffalo comes to AA. Just some of us are desperate enough to tell somebody about it. I wanted to share this about this inventory, and I'll get off of it. You know, when I got sober in the 70s, there wasn't a lot of talk in my area of the country about the big book. And if we did talk about the big, they called us fanatics or thumpers or something like that, just because they had never read it, really. And then in the 80s, the end of the 80s into the early 90s, we got big book seminars. Whoa. Wow. You know, it went from nobody reading it to let's dissect every word in the book. And, you know, and I got a guy that came to me, and he says, "Lord, what do you think of this?" And it was, I said, "What is this?" He said, "Well, it's a guide to the fourth step." I said, "You need a guide to the guide?" And when I looked at it, it looked like a computer flow chart. Like two resentments equal one fear and one low self-esteem squared or something. I was like, man, that hurts my head. You know, and I says, "You're missing out on what the book's talking about, son." I said, "When I read this, it's not about the form. It's the content. It's what's in it. I said, read on there about that inventory. Look at that guy. He's mad at Mr. Brown, his attention to his wife. He's mad at him. How's it make him feel? He wants to kill him. Mad at Mrs. Jones, she snubs me. How you feel about her? I'm going to kill her, too. Mad at my wife, misunderstands, nags, likes Brown, wants house put in her name. Well, how's that make you feel? I'm going to kill them all. Now, when it comes to the sex in the buffalo, does it really matter what column that's in? No. What matters is, let me explain this. I did it with the buffalo. That's what matters. I don't care if you're new and you write it down horizontally, vertically, diagonally on an old brown paper bag. The form is not important. It is the content. It's the thing that keeps me up night after night thinking, if they ever knew about that buffalo, they would never. You know what I mean? So, and I went back to my room that night, and I did this six and seven step. My first six and seven step was, how could you have embarrassed yourself in front of another human being like that? You just totally exposed yourself. That was dumb. That was dumb. That was my first reflection of my fifth step. Now, I know what the book says, but I was totally embarrassed. And I asked God for help. I said, well, it says here you're supposed to help me. I don't know what kind of help you're supposed to give me, but I know I'm supposed to ask you for help. And the whole point is, if you're new, you don't have to understand AA in order for it to work for you. You just have to be willing to try it. And I went and I started making amends to those people. I started making amends to my mother and my father. And I owed money to my father. My father wouldn't accept it. I said, Dad, I've got to pay you. That's what I do to stay sober. He says, well, guess you're going to get drunk. I don't want your money. And I went to my sponsor and I said, what do you think about that? He says, the main thing is you were willing to pay. You can't control how they accept your amends or not. You know, I hear people say, oh, give it to a charity. I said, don't do that. You didn't steal from the charity. Don't be too hard on yourself. This isn't too rough. And I was sober about 2 months. And I'm getting active in AA and I'm doing the things that my sponsor said he was doing. I'm finding myself liking it. It was like I was transformed. I didn't choose to be an alcoholic anymore, and I chose to be sober. I didn't know what sober was to choose it. I thought sober was not drinking. I didn't know anything about peace of mind and well-being and feeling useful. I didn't know anything about that. I was sober about 2 months. I called my sponsor up. I was scared to death. My mind was blank. Scared me to death. Mike, he said, what's wrong? I said, there's nothing on my mind. He said, that's peace of mind. You're going to have to get used to that. He said, that's what the steps do for us. It removes the obsession and renders us happy, whole, and useful. And I said, I have to ask you this. I said, you know I'm a chronic slipper. I says, I don't know if I'm lying to myself, but I was up to get cigarettes the other night at 7-Eleven, and I walked by the beer case, and I walked by the tuna. And I didn't want the tuna anymore, and I wanted the beer. They meant nothing to me. Am I lying to myself again? Am I like the little boy whistling in the dark? He says, no, Joe. He says, you're free. I said, free of what? He says, you're free of the obsession. If you had the obsession, you'd have never made it past the beer case. He said, that's what AA does for us. It removes the obsession and renders the sufferer happy, whole, and useful. I went, wow, I hope he's right. I hope he's right. And you know, one of the hardest things I've had to do since I've been sober is learn how to let life get better, because I have a tendency to booby trap myself. That obsession is a hard thing to unlearn. You know, for a lot of years, I used to think there's something I'm going to do that's so terrible. The obsession's going to come back and I'm going to drink again. You know, fear is a terrible thing. I was sober about 2 years and got married. About 2.5 years, I learned to fly a plane and got a pilot's license. 5 years sober, my wife had a little boy. I used to say, we had a boy. I saw it. She had it. Woo! The only thing I thought to myself is, things will never be the same. Huh? I thought, you know me, always thinking of others. And we named this little boy after my sponsor, Mike. He was a chronic bedwetter, but we really liked what A had done for him. And a year later, on the same day, she did it again. Wow, I was right. That isn't quite what I said, but you got the right idea. November the 20th, a year later, she had another little boy named Bob. We named him after my sponsor. He was a 2-time graduate of the local psych ward, but we really liked what A had done for him. And little Bobby was born with his feet on upside down. He had severe club feet. His feet were turned in like this and upside down, completely upside down like that. And I remember the doctor delivering the boy, and he's holding him up, and he said, "Oh, the boy's just fine." I'm 4 feet away. I thought, "I don't know about you, Doc. Kid looks like Flipper to me. Something wrong here. You know, I can see. I wasn't born yesterday." But, you know, we read this stuff in the big book about working with others. Oh, yeah, working with others. Yeah, help you stay sober. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of alcoholics in those 6 years, and they'd obviously kept me sober. But on that day, within 4 hours of that little boy being born, I'm sitting in a courtroom downtown at the Adams and Deputy Building at a pretrial sentencing. And I'm sitting there, and my mother's sitting here, and she's crying. And over here is my dad. He's rocking back and forth like a tiger in a cage. And they bring this alcoholic in. He's got handcuffs to a waist belt and shackles on his ankles. Been to A before, didn't think he needed it, thought he was a drug addict. He's facing 5 life sentences in the Ohio State Penitentiary for drinking whiskey. That alcoholic was my brother, and that was 20 years ago, and he's still there. But you know, it wasn't 20 years ago, it was just a moment ago. You know what I mean? It was just a moment ago. And I looked at him, and I looked at myself, and I thought, what's the difference between that man and me? And it was just so obvious. This man had Alcoholics Anonymous, and that guy didn't, but look what a difference it made. And he ended up doing 3 10- to 25-year sentences, and he's still there. He's going to be around rust on bars for a lot of years, I thought. And I had rust on my door on my car. It was really bothering me. I went back out to the lot that day. That's my rust. That's mine. That's really not. I like that. And I went back up to the hospital. And I told my wife, I said, "Don't you worry about Bob's feet. He's going to be fine." And I know she had to look at me like I was crazy. She said, "How do you know that?" I said, "I just know because that boy's daddy hasn't done something so terrible in a drunken stupor that he has to be removed from society." I watched a man lose the right to ever walk his daughters down the aisle and buy them their first dress or their first pair of nice shoes. I saw a man lose the opportunity to watch his boys play baseball, not hold baseball. I watched a man lose the opportunity to get old with his wife. It was ripped out of his life because of the obsession called alcoholism. I says, "If I have to, we'll just push that boy around. If it don't matter if he ever walks, I can kiss him on the cheek and tell him I love him. Everything's going to be okay." And that little boy's not so little anymore. He's taller than I am. He's like 6'1". He's an engineering student at the University of Cincinnati. He's got a double major in aeronautical engineering and German. And he's doing fine. He's doing great. The older boy, he's a third-year apprentice, electrical apprentice in the Electrical Workers Union. And it was just yesterday, I'm going to my home group going, "Do you think I'll be able to take care of these kids? I mean, am I going to have what it takes to take care of them?" I remember my sponsor saying, "You'll never have to worry about that." He said, "Your job is to enjoy them for the time that they're in your life. God's going to make sure those kids are going to grow up. They're going to grow up in spite of you, not because of you. Who do you think you are?" But, wow. Never thought of it like that. You know. And I'll have to say this. From time to time, I was not a good parent. From time to time, I was not a good husband. But you know what? I think I did the only thing I knew how. I've always been right where I was supposed to be. I've just objected to it sometimes. You know what I mean? Sometimes I've been too hard on the kids. I remember I was too hard on Bob, the youngest boy I was telling you about with table manners. And this is how AA works for me. This is how AA works for me. I was asked to speak in Grand Forks, North Dakota about, 12 years ago or something like that. And a guy who's a lawyer from Dallas was talking. There's nothing up there in Grand Forks, North Dakota. You turn around, you've seen everything. There's not even trees up there. Birds fall out of the sky. There's no place to land. And I'm talking with this guy, and this guy's a lawyer, and his son is a surgeon that works on kids' hands and feet, like my boy. And he had heard me before, and he goes, "We're talking at a Holiday Inn restaurant. This is not even at the meeting, but this is how God works for me in my life." He says, "You know, I often wonder, Joe, if I was too hard on my son." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you ever notice that AA, when people spill a cup of coffee, we laugh and we joke about it, thinking, look at that, sober and still spilling stuff. Let me get a paper towel, I'll help you wipe it up. But let one of our kids spill a cup of coffee or a drink on a coffee table, and it's, Jesus, how many times do I have to tell you? If you can't hold on to it, don't bring it in here." So why is it that we give people in AA more slack than we do our own family? I says, "I really don't know. I've never really thought about it." And I went home after that weekend, and on Monday, Bob dropped everything. he would drop air if he was eating it. And I'm sitting in my recliner in the living room, and I'm looking through the kitchen, and Bob drops a piece of butter bread, butter side down, on the tile floor in the kitchen. And he looks at me like, oh, here comes Dad from hell. Because that's how I was. I didn't know I was that way until Jerry gave me a different thought. I said, hey, Bob. He went, what, Dad? Because he knew it was coming. He knew the hammer was coming down. I thought to myself, how would I treat that boy if he was a member of AA? I said, hey, Bob. He goes, what? I said, tap your foot on the floor. He said, why? I said, hell, the dog would get it. And he tapped his foot on the floor, and the dog came in and said, there's still some butter down there, Dad. I said, tap your foot again. And it went over and licked up the rest of the butter, and we're laughing. I said, look at that. We have a Hoover on four legs that's got hair. What do you think of that? You know what I mean? But that is how AA works for me. That is how AA has taught me how to get along with my wife and my kids. And I got 5 minutes here, and I've got my hour. I'm not even going to go over 60 minutes, I don't think. We had just lived in our house for about 7 years, and my wife at the time was a stay-at-home mom, which is the best thing I thought was ever that I've had the opportunity to experience, because those boys had a good upbringing through their mother. If anything, their dad might have been whacked out, but their mother added some stability I couldn't. And I called her from work. I said, what are you doing? She says, I'm cleaning the closet in the bedroom. I said, oh, okay. Now, we had lived there 7 years. I know where all my stuff is. I could find it in my sleep blindfolded. Well, guys, when she says she's cleaning, that's code for rearranging everything. They just don't clean it and put it back. They find new positions and don't tell you nothing about it. And I went home, and I looked up, and all my stuff is gone. I said, Vanessa, you said you were cleaning. Oh my! I could find that stuff in my sleep. I mean, I just lost it. I says, now I got to get up on a chair and memorize all the new positions of where my stuff's at, or I got to go, hey Vanessa, where's my stuff? Leave my stuff alone. I was so mad, I was just sweating. I mean, it was terrible. I act like a 4-year-old. Then I went to my regular Monday night penitentiary meeting. And I'm sitting in a meeting, and I'm looking around, and all of a sudden it occurs to me, there's not one man in here who has his own closet. I think maybe I've been making too big a deal out of this whole thing. And I went home. I said, you know what I said about my stuff in the closet? She said, yeah. I says, I meant it. I said, but I really could have worded it a lot better, couldn't I? That's how AA works for me. It's not about direct instruction. It's about an awakening of the spirit. It's about a change in attitude toward people in life. I had taken a trip to Europe, and me and my youngest boy, we went to Zurich, Switzerland, and we were going to spend 14 days in Europe. And the first 10 days, it was just me and him. And the last 4 days, we were going to be with my wife and my oldest boy. And we left on different planes. They started out in Paris, and we started out in Zurich, the long way from a mattress on Skid Row. And I had a plan. I could tell her what days we were going to be in what cities, and we'll meet you in The Hague the last 4 days. We'll stay at the Kurhaus in the North Sea in The Hague. And I said, what are you guys going to do? So I just knew they were going to be in Paris for 3 days. And after that, they said, oh, we'll wing it. We'll meet you there. I said, okay. So my son, me and Bob, the guy that I was just so hard on, we had such a good time being with each other. We went to Zurich and Interlaken and Lucerne, and we rode the trains. We went to Munich. We went to Dachau. We went to the Marienplatz. We went to the Hofbrauhaus and watched people drink big steins of beer and sing songs. And we went to the Porsche Museum. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. And we had 2 days to kill. And we didn't have anywhere to go. So he said, I want to show you this place in Brussels. I said, okay. So we're riding on the train. And he says, there's a church here in Cologne, Germany. Can we get off and look at it? I said, yeah, let's get off. Let's get off and look at it. We got off. We looked for a couple hours. Got back on the train. And we're riding along for a while. And I says, Bob, there's a little town called Bruges. It looks closer to where we're going to meet your mom and your brother at. Why don't we go there instead of Brussels? He says, okay. So we get off. And we get off the train. And there's no place to change over the currency from francs to whatever they were using. Like, oh, no. And I had to talk a cabbie into taking us to a bank. And we got a place. And there's just thousands of people on the square in Bruges, Belgium. Just thousands of people. And we're walking along. And, oh, my knee's killing me. Oh, it's just killing me. I said, Bob, let's sit down here. And we sat there for about 45 minutes and rested my knee. And then we got back out and we went on the square. And there's just thousands. August. There's thousands of people. I said, Bob, I had a dream. I saw your mom last night. I said, I really wish we'd get to spend more than 4 days together. He said, yeah, but if she was here, how would you ever find her? Look at these thousands of people, Dan. I said, well, it was just a dream. I miss your mom and your brother. I'm just speaking out loud, you know. So we went up to get some mussels, buckets of mussels on the square in Belgium. And we're sitting there eating, and I get up to pay. And you can ask my wife. She's here. I walked up to the maitre d', and I down the street I heard somebody say, hey, Killer Joe. I thought, who the hell knows me in Belgium? And I looked down the street, and it was my wife and my oldest son. And I looked at Bob. I said, we didn't have to look for them. They found us. And that's not the whole story. My wife had went to Paris for 3 days and didn't have too good of a time, so they left. And they went to the little town of Bruges that we were in. They stayed there 4 days. They went looking for us in the Netherlands for a day or so. The next day they come back. They were delayed 5 hours by a gas leak on the rail lines before they could come back. And they went back and stayed at the same place. And my son told my wife, let's walk up this street, Mom. We were never up this street when we were here before. And there we were. And I had a profound spiritual experience. And this is how I'm going to end my talk. I realized from the time I left the United States and my wife left the United States, everything happened the way it was supposed to happen. It couldn't have happened any other way. Had we not got off that train and looked at the church in Cologne, we'd have never met. Had there been a currency exchange there, boom, 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 we'd have been gone. We'd never been delayed. We'd have never met. Had my knee stopped bothering me, we'd have never met. Was my knee bothering me a good or a bad thing? Wasn't. It was necessary. Was the delay good or bad? Wasn't. It was on her end, was not having a good time in Paris good or bad? It was neither. It was necessary. If they'd have liked Paris and stayed one more day, we'd have never met. They were delayed by a gas leak on the rail lines that delayed them for 5 hours. Was that good or bad? Neither. It was necessary. If it wouldn't have happened, we'd have never met. And all of a sudden, it just came full circle in my life. But I realized that everything I've ever said and done sober, none of it was good and bad. It was all necessary. If I could have done it another way, by God, I would have. Sometimes I haven't been too good of a husband. Sometimes I guess I say I've been a bastard. Couldn't have done it any other way. Couldn't have happened any other. Sometimes I've been a good father. Sometimes I haven't. But it couldn't have happened any other way. I needed to make every mistake and hurt everybody that I've hurt and stepped on their toes. And then again, all the positive things, too. It was all necessary for me to be here tonight. It could not have happened any other way. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, take a look around. This is no show. Do you think we all end up here by accident? Whoopsie! We all just ran into each other this weekend. I don't think so. I think we're sitting next to the people that we're supposed to be sitting next to because it's necessary for our spiritual growth. That hopefully we walk away from this meeting and the other meetings this weekend, walking away going, you know, this sobriety thing is okay. I feel better now than when I first came. This is really a wonderful thing. I think if it worked for a goofball guy like that guy that spoke tonight, maybe I have a chance. Maybe I can do this thing. And if you're new in your first 90 days or 6 months, I'm going to make you a promise. That if you make AA and staying sober the most important thing in your life, you'll never have to worry about money. You won't have to worry about a job. You won't have to worry about relationships because they'll all be taken care of for you. But you know what? You will worry. You'll worry because it's necessary. Thank you very much. Hey, good seeing you, buddy.